I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's an important year for an iconic Kansas City structure. The block building at the Nelson Atkins is 10 years old, and its designer was in town last week to celebrate the milestone. Today, listen in as architect Stephen Hull reflects on his influences and how well his building is holding up a decade later. Then, there's an epidemic going on, and most people don't know it. Before 1995, this country saw one megafire a year. Now that number's up to almost 10. We'll explore why these bigger, more intense, more devastating wildfires are happening more often. Bill Brownlee returns later with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This year marks the 10th anniversary of a building that's become a Kansas City icon, plopped down right next to another Kansas City icon. The block building at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art has stood now for a decade. Along the eastern edge of the museum, its interconnected shapes, its eye-catching glow, and its contents making a mark on the Kansas City art scene. On Friday, KCUR's Brian Ellison spoke with the building's architect, Stephen Hull. Let's listen.
Stephen Hull, welcome to Up to Date.
Pleasure to be here.
So you are here in Kansas City to celebrate the block building's 10th anniversary pick up an award or two while you're here. What's it been like to be back in town?
Terrific. It was great to see Henry Block, 94 years old, showing up and actually sitting through my one-hour lecture called Architecture Activating the Brain. An academic lecture, really, that I gave, but there was a full auditorium there, and afterwards they had a little ceremony giving some awards. But the building looks terrific. I mean, you know, a building that looks as new as this looks after 10 years is rare. So I'm very proud of that.
I know it's not your first time back in the space, but what do you think of how it has evolved since you designed it?
I think there's been terrific additions. Piece of artwork by Robert Morris called The Maze, the Roxy Payne tree in the landscape, fantastic. And, the different works that Julian, the new director, has been able to, you know, get for the museum and the different shows. I saw the Picasso show, which I think is a must-see for everyone, the relation of the African original masks, some 200 years old, and of Picasso's sketches and paintings. It's a very informative and very inspiring show.
You know, I'm sure that as an architect, you design it, you're there when it opens, everyone's excited, and then you have to sort of walk away, and whatever they do with it, it's up to them.
That's right.
Do you ever regret decisions that have been made about how your space gets decorated or filled or somehow changed after you leave?
No, I mean, as an architect, you make a work that is as publicly inviting as you possibly can, and you try to think of all the possible ways it could be used, and then you try to make it open-ended, and then you turn it over to the public. And I think it's been very important that Mark Wilson was a terrific director. He guided us through the whole process of realizing this important building, and Julian has been able to take over in his shoes and run this wonderfully, and so it's a thriving place.
What do you notice when you come back now? What do you notice that's different? Are there things that stand out to you that different than when you were there before?
I notice the art, of course. I mean, the one of the great pieces is the Rodin Thinker that's right in the center of that axis of the neoclassical building. And I was looking at it this morning for the first time, reading the inscription on the plaque, where when asked about why this was important, he said he's thinking not only with his mind, but with the muscles in his body and with his whole, you know, the mind and body relationship. And, you know, I've been here, I don't know how many times, and I never saw that before. I never read that particular. I think one of the great things about a place like this with so many dimensions, you know, is you can come back and return again and again and again and always see something new. So, because there's so much depth in the, you know, in the existing collection, of course, but also in the now the sculpture garden. Today I was really excited about the Chiida. I think Chiida is one of my favorite sculptors. He died in 2002, but he studied as an architect originally.
There's an exhibition of his work outdoors.
Exactly.
Throughout the grounds of the museum.
There's several pieces, and it takes a few. You can't see it right at once. It's spread across the landscape. But this morning at 10 o'clock when I was there, it was a golden sunlight shining through the ginkgo leaves, which are just getting ready to turn their beautiful golden color and hang on the trees for like 3 weeks. They're the most greatest trees. And looking at those next to the Corten steel of the Chiida piece, next to the glass of our building, I got some beautiful photographs. It was the thrilling thrilling feeling.
And inside the building now, of course, there's the gates to occupy prominent space.
Right. And someone asked, would the architect be upset about that? Of course not. What I originally envisioned was that great stone lion that's in the existing building, that would be, you know, at the arrival point at the top of the ramp in Lens 1, in that main entranceway. So I always had the feeling there ought to be, you know, a non-light sensitive work of art, major piece in that. And so the gates arriving there is a great pleasure to see. I mean, I studied in Rome, lived in Italy for a year, and had great experience with the Duomo and Brunelleschi. So the Ghiberti baptismal gates, I mean, those were something that's part of my education. So to see this, you know, very authentic recasting of this incredible historic period of the Renaissance, it's a great pleasure. And I think it really adds to the power of the depth of this incredible collection of the Nelson Atkins.
You know, it's been 10 years, of course, and they are such a part, your buildings are such a part of the landscape of Kansas City now that they don't strike us the way they did at first, which was with great controversy. There was a lot of question over whether these very modern-looking buildings should be sitting next to the classical architecture of the Nelson Atkins Museum.
There's an exhibit that Julian, the director, put up on the wall celebrating the 10th anniversary that has all these newspaper articles. And, you know, there's one front-page article that says, "Architect returns to defend his vision," you know. And, yeah, I remember the controversy and, you know, I think whenever you do something that reaches for the ideal, which really I believe all architecture should, you will have some people who are questioning because you're doing something fresh, you're doing something new, you're doing something that's aspiring to the beyond. And I think that's happened through the history of architecture. It will continue to happen. So I welcome the controversy as a kind of, let's say, it's a part of the process of creative work. Certainly in music you have, you know, the they walked out of Le Sacre du Printemps, the Rite of Spring of Stravinsky, that half the audience walked out, 1913 in Paris. But look, we look back at Stravinsky's works, these are classical, part of our canon now.
Because they pushed the envelope. They
absolutely
made us think. Which, it's funny you mention music, because you teach at Columbia University, I know, and you teach there a course about the connection between music and architecture.
Absolutely. One of the things that I think is needed today more than ever is to bring back the relationship between the arts. Architecture, poetry, painting, music, sculpture, these things are all related, as they were in the Renaissance. Renaissance is so important because all these interrelations between things. So one way of doing that today, and with my wife, Demeter Zagrelia, we teach a class called the Architectonics of Music. And we take a piece of music, and usually it's by something by Morton Feldman, maybe, or John Cage, or Ioannis Xenakis. These composers, or modern composers, that made what I called geometric equivalent music. You can almost envision shapes when you hear certain pieces. And we have this, we assign the students a fragment of music or a site, and then ask them to make an equivalent in architectural space. And it's it was an experimental studio that I started maybe 10 years ago, but we keep going on because we found that it has, limitless possibilities for stimulating creativity in architecture students.
I'm thinking about an exhibit last year in one of your spaces in the Block Building, the Janet Cardiff's 40-part motet,
right,
which was 40 speakers in sort of an oval around the room, each one with a different voice. And I watched people at that exhibit go in, and of course they find the music transcendent, but their eyes have to go somewhere, and where their eyes went was your architecture.
I wish I could have been here to hear that piece. I saw it on video, and I think it would have been a fantastic experience. I heard it brought tears to people's eyes when they were like experiencing this.
It was
sound sculpture, she calls it.
That's right, and it really was quite powerful. I'm wondering. I know that you've designed many museums, some before this, some after this. Is there a lot of extra pressure on an architect when you are designing a piece of art that is specifically designed to house art, as opposed to building a school or an office building or a home?
Yes, I think, there's a video by a Japanese company. You can find it on I think Vimeo or YouTube, from the Kiasma Museum in Helsinki, where the director is taking people through the museum explaining, and this building is going to be 20 years old in 2018, and she's explaining that I, as an architect, eliminated the middle scale. She says, Stephen has the big scale, the building, the spaces, and the small scale, these wonderful details, the door handles, but the middle scale, that's for art. And that's kind of a principle that we've used over the years to try to make, to a place that the art absolutely is in the foreground, but without making a neutral white box that I think sucks the life out of art. There's sort of, I always say that there's kind of three kinds of museums. There's the kind that are a bunch of white neutral boxes that suck the life out of art, like the Museum of Modern Art, I'm sorry to say, in New York. Yeah. Is really a kind of series of very boring spaces. And then there's the problem of the overexpressive museum, where the whole museum is like the foil coming off of a turkey after Thanksgiving, and you don't have the feeling of relation for the art. So we always try for a third way, which would be to have spatial energy bring you through, but leave the middle scale for the art, so that the art can be foregrounded by the spaces that you're shaping for art, by the way, and for the public. And they have to have a certain flexibility and longevity, because these exhibits will change, the art will change. So the frame of the museum space, has to do a lot in terms of giving spatial energy and interest. And natural light is key, I think, also for this kind of spatial energy, but being neutral for the art. I think it's a balance.
We're talking to Stephen Hall, the architect behind the Block Buildings at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. One of the things you have written about, and you have a book called Anchoring, and it's a book about anchoring architectural design in the site, in a place, in a particular setting. Take us back 10 years, or more than 10 years, when you first saw the site where this proposed building was to be. What did you see there, and how did that find expression in the building that you designed?
Well, right from the beginning, I doubted the brief. The program said that we were supposed to add directly onto the north facade of the 1933 original neoclassical building. And I thought, wow, that's not a great idea. I mean, the more idealistic approach would not be to block the facades of the original building. I mean, it's quite a wonderful composition in stone.
There was a competition. Those were the rules for the competition.
If you go and look at the exhibit that Ulian put up, you can see the other schemes, and they all go right up against the north facade.
Which is what they were asked to do.
They were asked to do, and I said, that's not the ideal, And when I presented our scheme, I read this inscription out of the facade that's on the right-hand side, or the left-hand side, if you're looking at the original building from the garden. It says, the soul has greater need of the ideal than of the real. And I said, I've got the courage to break your rules, because I'm following the directive in your original facade. this is the ideal approach where you won't, you know, build up against any of your original facades. You'll come in, tuck in from below, from the side, and actually the columns that were on that elevation were elevated off the ground, and in a certain sense we placed them back on the ground where they should be, because then we go in from below and up the stair, and the auditorium is accessible from the main level of the new building. We had to do a little incision, you know, kind of like a, what I would say is like a bypass when someone opens up your heart and does a little bypass to make this all work. And that was key, because once they could see that they could move perpendicular circulation to the new addition.
Into the east side
exactly,
of the existing building.
Right. And then it just opened up a whole possibility that they didn't foresee. But I think that they could understand that circulation from our competition entry. That's why we had a unanimous support for our approach.
And the rest of that site, the rest of that hillside sort of cascading down down toward Emanuel Cleaver Boulevard down there, what did you see that said this five building structure is the one that will fit?
Well, you know, it's a process. The original competition had seven lenses. It's the general concept that was approved. And then we had to make very careful analysis and studies and, you know, the circulation studies. And the loading dock was a big challenge, how that was going to work. It's really beautifully buried into the composition. So it's a process of a couple of years of work and, you know, meeting with people and understanding everything. So what the competition proposed is a general concept. And what's actually built is a vast improvement over the, you know, the first sketches in the competition.
You've also written about creating spaces from the perspective of human movement. Is that reflected in this
Absolutely.
Design?
You know, the real experience of architecture is the body moving through the spaces. Your eyeballs are 5 feet, 6 inches off the ground. You walk through a series of spaces. The perspectives overlap. The spaces unfold. That's the key. You know, we don't start by drawing a floor plan. We start by thinking about perspectives and making perspectives and building models and understanding it spatially. That's what I call parallax, the movement, how the spaces change as the body moves through space. And that's been a key to my work since the very beginning, that I started to work these theories 30 years ago. And the first building that I realized it was the Chiasma Museum in Helsinki. And when we were interviewed and we were in the middle of this process, Don Hall flew his private plane over to Helsinki and they walked through my spaces in that museum. And I think they realized that there's a lot more going on spatial energy-wise than what you could see in a floor plan. You can't read it in the floor plan.
You've mentioned the museum in Helsinki. Well, where does this museum, the block building, where does that fit into your overall body of work as you see it? How does it compare to the rest of what you've done?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important. I mean, Time magazine said it was the most important building of the year when it opened. The fact that it looks so beautiful and it's kept up so well today, 10 years later. We recently won the competition for the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, which is under construction now, but again, one of the reasons we won that competition is they visited the Nelson. So the Nelson had some influence on their decision. I think it's one of my most important works that I will ever do. I mean, you know, an architect is not going to build a lot of buildings. The average building from the first sketch to the opening in our practice takes 8 years.
Wow.
And that's because we've been involved in a lot of places where we have to make community, like the Princeton Lewis Center for the Arts that just opened October 6th took us 10 years. And 4 years were lost making community presentations and going back and forth. So the fact is, you know, there's going to be a limited number of buildings that you're going to realize. So when you look at that, I would say out of, you know, maybe I've realized maybe 50 things, 50 works. But if I have to choose what are my most important, I would say the Chapel of St. Ignatius in my hometown of Seattle, and the Nelson Atkins Museum, because they are, you know, they're idealistic. You know, they're very idealistic, and they were built well, and both of them look spectacular today. The chapel is going to be 20 years old, and this building is 10 years old, but they're both in perfect condition, kept up by the people who love the spaces. And you know, of course, there's maintenance. There has to be maintenance on anything. But the fact is they look as good and as fresh today as they did when they were first opened. So, yeah, they're very important. And also they're both working with light. You know, my favorite and I think one of the most important materials is light and space. And by the way, light is free. You know,
right.
It's not about being expensive. You know, someone say, how much did this cost and how much did that cost? Space and light, these are the most important materials. And, you know, that's not expensive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say that the Nelson is a key moment in my career.
A lot of your work has been in China. And I wonder about that. Is that because there's a particular match between your sensibilities and what developers in China are looking for, or is that just where the building is happening these days?
That was a coincidence in my life. I was invited to do the Nanjing Museum by Isasaki, and that was my first project, and it was 2001 or two, and I went to China. Actually, the first time I went to China was 2001. I had never been to China. And the next year, I had an invitation to do this museum. So while I was there, this developer in Beijing got wind of, you know, and I had some things published. I was known. And they invited me to do 8 towers, 32 stories tall, in the middle of Beijing. And I was very skeptical. I said, well, you know, I said, let me make an ideal proposal for you. Again, this idea of the ideal. They wanted me to just do the skin of these. So I said, let me have 3 months and 200,000, and I'm going to make an ideal proposal. So we did. And we came back with these, a very idealistic thing. And there was a cinematheque in the center. There was recycled water. It was all geothermally heated and cooled. There are bridges that connect the towers. And one bridge had a swimming pool in it. And all these ideas that just made this project like a utopian piece of Beijing. And the thing is, you have to understand, the moment was the Olympics, 2008. It was just, they could feel that they were going to be on the world spotlight, and every developer, every project was seen in that relation, and they just said, "We want to build it all. We want to build everything you drew." I said, "Really?" I couldn't believe it. They built the swimming pool and the bridge. Yeah, they built everything—the swimming pool hanging in the bridge, everything.
One more thing: it's been a big week for you and your firm. I see you just won the competition to design the new operational center for Doctors Without Borders,
yes,
in Geneva.
Very proud of that.
You mentioned the light being an important part of your work. Tell us about this project that's now going to be built.
Well, I think for me, architecture has a social mission. I want to make, you know, the public spaces. I'm always trying to do what I call a social condenser, that the project has something to give back to the people in some way. So, you know, the different projects that I do. But in this case, in Geneva, it's also, this is a social organization that has a global mission. And yeah, it was there are 6 firms competing for this project. And, you know, I was skeptical about it. And I have a developer friend, Philippe Journeau, who's in my office because we're also working on the transformation of the Gare du Nord 2024. You know, Paris has got the Olympics in 2024. So you have the same atmosphere as was in Beijing. They're going to do things for 2024. So he's in my office. I show him the scheme, and he says, you know, that's a winning scheme. It's the colors of humanity. In a way, he read my scheme. I was using colors in this cubic geometry, but there are solar energy PVs that are on the facade built into the curtain wall. And it's a new technique that we can do. We can provide 75% of the power of the building from the facades, from the east,
wow,
south, and west. And he said, you've got to fly there and present it. So I did. The next week, I flew to Geneva, and I presented it. And it was a good thing I did, because there were 18 doctors in the room, and I had to change some of the design right there because we didn't have operable windows in all the rooms.
Ah.
I said, of course we can have operable windows in all the rooms.
And you had said, no, now how am I going to put windows?
No, if I hadn't have been there to present it, I don't think we would have won. But I'm very proud of it because I really respect their organization. I think they're doing a fantastic job on this fragile earth today.
Well, congratulations on that competition, and congratulations on 10 years of the Block Building. Stephen Hall, one of the great American architects and designer of the Block Building at the Nelson Atkins, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was KCUR's Brian Ellison's interview with architect Stephen Hall, recorded last Friday. Time for a break. When we come back, a conversation about the changing nature of wildfires. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we learned about how an ill-fated ascent of Mount Everest inspired an opera. Also, we get tips from Kansas City chefs on serving hundreds of high-profile guests. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we learn about how a Kansas researcher is going to battle against antibiotic-resistant bacteria as the number of infections caused by these germs continues to rise. Well, what used to be called wildfires are now called something else, megafires. Megafires are bigger, more intense, more devastating, and they are sweeping the globe. In fact, prior to 1995, this country experienced but one megafire a year. But between 2005 and 2014, the average jumped to nearly 10 a year. Michael Kotis has written a new book on this, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. He's the deputy director of the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado, and he's also the author of High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. And Michael, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
The increase in these huge fires is just astonishing to me. Exactly what kinds of increases in these fires are we seeing out there?
Well, we're seeing, you know, both an increase in the size of wildfires and in the frequency of wildfires, you know, particularly since around the 1970s when the U.S. was at its peak as far as fighting wildfires. So there's a lot of different ways to measure that increase. Back in 2006, one scientific paper that came out showed about a six-fold increase in the number of wildfires, or six-fold increase in the amount of land burning, and a four-fold increase in the number of wildfires in the, you know, over about a 20-year period. But we also see this measured in other things like, say, finances. Back in 2005 or 1995, mm-hmm. About 15 or 16% of the Forest Service budget went to fighting wildfires. And this year, it'll be about 56% of the Forest Service budget that will be spent dealing with wildfires.
And these trends are unmistakable in your mind, Michael. I mean, this isn't just a blip on the radar screen. This is something that appears to be enduring.
It's not only is it enduring, but science shows us that it's going to continue into the coming decades. So back in 2015, for the first time since the U.S. government kept such records, we had more than 10 million acres of the United States burn in wildfires. And Forest Service scientists anticipate by the middle of this century, we'll see twice that amount of land, about 20 million acres burning in bad fire years. That's an area nearly the size of the state of Maine burning in a single year in the United States.
I mean, that's just frightening.
It is, and particularly if you have moved into flammable landscapes, if you're in one of the more than one in three homes in the United States that researchers say are in the wildland-urban interface, the area where development abuts flammable forests, and consequently you're at risk of losing your home or your life in a wildfire.
And these fires are also, they're burning in unusual ways. I mean, the fires are behaving differently. In fact, they're burning downhill in some cases instead of just uphill. How else? What else are you seeing out there?
Well, one thing that's really confounded firefighters is fires that rage through the night. They basically don't calm down at night. And it used to be that wildland firefighters could kind of count on the temperatures dropping at night, the humidity rising enough where a bit of moisture got onto the fuels, and that would calm the fire overnight and give firefighters a chance in the early morning to get a jump on a wildfire because it would be kind of just waking up, and it really really wouldn't pick up until maybe 10 or so in the morning. And that's happening far less frequently now, particularly when we look at, say, the fires that occurred in Northern California last month. These fires rage straight through the night. We also see fires that actually start at night, which used to be fairly rare. So, you know, fires burning downhill is another thing that you mentioned, where, you know, the weather conditions are so great that, you know, the humidity so low, the temperature so high, that it can heat up fuels below the fire and have those fuels ignite, whereas traditionally fire likes to run uphill rather than downhill.
So I gather that human firefighters then are less effective at combating these things as they used to be?
They're less effective at combating these things than they used to be, but there's a bit of a... you know, a misconception in all of that. It, you know, it's easy to look back at, say, the 60s and 70s when we were more successful at fighting wildfires and think, well, you know, what were we doing differently back then? And, you know, we do a lot more to fight wildfires now than we did back then, but the conditions have changed. Back when we were really successful at fighting wildfires, we actually had weather conditions and the climate on our side, and we don't have that anymore.
I was going to say, how do human firefighters fight these things? What do they do, Michael?
Well, so the primary way that a wildland firefighter fights a fire is with dirt rather than with water. And you'll have crews of all those men and women in green pants and yellow shirts marching into the woods. And they basically will dig a trail with no vegetation left in it around a fire, trying to contain it. Basically, you're trying to corral that fire. And then you can have, you know, aircraft dropping retardant and water to try to bolster that fire line. But by and large, you're either shoveling dirt onto the flames or clearing away all the fuel and leaving dirt in its place so that the fire can't get across, you know, this line that you build around it.
Why is dirt more effective at squashing a fire than water?
It's not so much that the dirt is more effective, it's that getting the amount of water that you would need to fight one of these big fires into the woods is virtually impossible. You know, water is just a very difficult resource to come by in big woodlands, particularly in the West, where the landscape is more arid to begin with. And so the strategy is really entirely different. Rather than trying to drown the flames, you're trying to deprive the flames of fuel. And so you use a dirt road, effectively, that line you dig around the fire, to deprive the fire of fuel that would allow it to continue to spread.
Michael Kotas is my guest. His new book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. Let's get a definition straight. How do you define a megafire?
That has been something that's been very difficult for people that work in this realm. In fact, I start out in the book at a conference of fire researchers from around the world. And, you know, at the end of the conference, there's a fairly healthy debate among them about how do we define a megafire. And when I went to that conference, I was really focused on these huge wildfires that are moving faster and burning hotter than they had in the past. You know, and you know, we see lots of photos of these really huge, dramatic fires with flames leaping hundreds of feet into the air. But by the time I'd finished the book, I'd kind of redefined megafire in my mind. And kind of discovered, you know, particularly going to a lot of mass fatality events or events where people had lost their homes or communities were really damaged, and learned that a lot of these fires were actually very small. They wouldn't have met the Forest Service standard for a megafire, which is any fire that's bigger than 100,000 acres. But a very small fire that behaves differently than fires have in the past in a certain landscape, and consequently can kill a lot of people, destroy a lot of homes, destroy resources we depend on, like watersheds, can be far more mega than a fire much bigger than 100,000 acres that's burning in a remote wilderness where fires like that have always burned and really don't threaten a lot of human resources.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Michael Kotas, his book, Megafire. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Andy from Blue Springs, good morning. You there, Andy? I think Andy had a question, Michael.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go quickly if you would, Andy.
Right. I checked your numbers with EPA. They've got charts that show the numbers and acreage of fires burned from forest fires from about 1983 to 2015. They aren't showing any increase at all, let alone a six-fold increase. Why do your numbers disagree?
Well, the numbers that I'm giving you are from a paper in 2006 that fire researchers from throughout the country worked on. And I'm not sure. EPA is not the source that I use for my numbers on wildfire. I go to the U.S. Forest Service and the National Interagency Fire Center, which actually measures this. And if you go to their data, you can see a pretty stark increase in year-by-year numbers in wildfire. The researchers that whose paper first got me interested in this topic were both counting the number of fires burning in a year and the amount of terrain that had burned in that year. So
EPA numbers aren't as good as National Forest Service numbers, is what you're saying?
Well, the EPA isn't in charge of wildfire. The Environmental Protection Agency deals with things related to fighting wildfires, like, say, what's in retardant mixtures and things like that. Mm-hmm. But as far as fighting wildfires, that's the job of the Forest Service, the Department of Interior, land management agencies, and the EPA is not a land management agency.
How much damage, Michael, are we seeing in terms of dollar loss each year, and how is that changing from year to year?
Well, back in the early 1990s, the United States spent about $300,000 or $300 million a year fighting wildfires, recovering after wildfires burn, preparing for wildfires, and mitigating landscapes so that wildfires weren't as damaging. In a bad fire year like we've just seen, that number easily tops $3 billion now.
Wow.
And
wow.
So it devastates not just federal budgets, but also state budgets and municipal budgets.
I guess the billion-dollar question then becomes, how much of a factor is climate change here?
Well, climate is a big player in this. We are seeing increasing incidents of drought and higher temperatures. One way that climate has impacted wildfires, particularly in the West, is that our snowpack doesn't last as long into the spring. Often we're getting less snow in the mountains, and that snow, because of higher temperatures, melts off earlier in the spring. Sometimes the snow doesn't fly until later in the season. And when you see a snow-capped mountain above a big green forest, that peak is basically a trickle reservoir that keeps the forest below it moist. So when the peaks dry out earlier in the season, then the forests below them become more flammable mm-hmm. earlier in the season. So climate impacts on wildfire are estimated by scientists to have expanded the wildfire season across the country by about 78 days now. So mm-hmm. we have a much longer wildfire season. And in places like California and Colorado, where I live, we actually see wildfires in seasons like the winter, where we really didn't see many wildfires before.
You know, earlier this year in March, Kansas experienced its largest wildfire ever. Are these fires out on the prairie a product of the same conditions you're talking about in your book?
To some degree, they are. Grasslands are as dependent on fire as forests are. And that's one thing to kind of understand when we talk about wildfires, is that almost any vegetated landscape has a fire cycle, and fire is needed in that landscape for the forest or the grassland to be healthy. So the climate projections for the plains show a pretty radical increase in the number of grass fires, wildfires that burn in finer fuels in Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and areas like that. But, coming from Kansas myself, I also know that many of the ranchers, particularly in, say, the Flint Hills, have for decades ignited the grasslands there on purpose and burned them off because cattle that graze on grass that's growing on a recently burned field gain far more weight. And in fact, the Native Americans that moved into the plains understood this, and some tribes would actually burn a field adjacent to where they planned to have their camp the next year because they knew the bison would come and graze on that new grass that came up, and it would shorten their commute.
You know, a lot of our listeners will recall the Yarnell, Arizona mega fire in 2013 that claimed the lives of 19 hotshot firefighters who are considered the best of the best. What happened there?
You know, there are a lot of drivers on the big increase that we're seeing in wildfires in the country, and pretty much every single one of them came to bear on the Granite Mountain Hotshots, who were the only hotshot crew in the country that were part of a municipal fire department. Prescott, Arizona, where they were based, is one of the most threatened cities in the country by wildfires, and having a hotshot crew as part of their municipal fire department seemed like a fairly clever solution to the threats that they face, because a hotshot crew works for the federal government, and when the Granite Mountain Hotshots were on the road fighting wildfires around the country, then the city got reimbursed for their time and their work, and that made their efforts nearly cost neutral in the city of Prescott. Unfortunately, it also meant that they were probably more prone to want to save structures than a lot of other hotshot crews might be, because they worked with structure firefighters and were part of a structure firefighting department. In the town of Yarnell, where they fought the Yarnell Hill Fire, they were really only about a 30-minute drive from the city where they were based, and consequently knew people in the area and knew the town. The town itself was both very threatened by wildfire, and most of the residents had done very little to prepare for wildfire. Mm-hmm. So when the fire burned into the city, the Granite Mountain Hotshots could see the fire exploding and burning into the city. And although they at that point were in a safety zone in what firefighters call the black, where the fire had already come through and burned away most of the vegetation, they chose to descend into a canyon that was a death trap. We really don't know exactly what their thinking was, because there were no survivors of the burnover and no witnesses to their last moments alive. But the real, the only explanation that anybody can really come up with is that they were trying to get to the town of Yarnell to help protect homes and try to protect this town that had done very little to protect itself.
Now, you write that these guys were literally fighting a monster, that winds exceeding 50 miles an hour had pushed 70-foot flames there until they were horizontal. And you pointed out that the fire front had traveled from about 100 yards in 19 seconds. A well-trained firefighter needs about 20 seconds to deploy a shelter. That's just incredible to me that the fire that day moved faster than even these hotshots could handle.
And that's one of the challenges that wildland firefighters are facing, is that the fires are moving much faster. They burn hotter. They do things that aren't in keeping with what they've done historically, so they're more unpredictable. But they've also, wildland firefighters are increasingly having to deal with human development in wooded areas. When I re-upped my red card to fight wildfires while I was working on this book, I hadn't done that in about 20 years, and one of the little modules that we went through in our training was, what do you do when you run into a meth lab in the forest when you're a wildland firefighter? And how do you deal with power lines? And, you know, various things that we really didn't have to think about 20 years ago, because basically wildland firefighters were really just fighting fires in the forest. And, you know, the other complication with that is the number of homes that we have building into flammable landscapes. It's much easier for a firefighter to step back from a bunch of burning trees and say, hey, this is too dangerous. It's far more difficult when it's a home, particularly if it's a home where you might actually know the residents.
You know, Michael, I've got 30 seconds here. You began this project thinking that fires were along the lines of a natural disaster, but you came to realize that these are something very different than that.
Yeah, the ones that we really focus on are really not very natural, the ones that are really disastrous. If we look at the fires that burned in Northern California last month, across the country, recent research here at the University of Colorado shows that about 84% of wildfires are started by humans. And in Northern California, that number is around 95%. So the fires themselves are started by humans, not necessarily by arson or a cigarette out the window, which is what we usually think of, but by power lines and sparks from vehicles. things. Wow. And even golfers accidentally hitting rocks with their golf clubs have started major wildfires. But we've also changed the structure of our forests, you know, by building houses and then putting in propane tanks and adding various other forms of fuel.
Michael Kotas is the author of Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. Michael, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
It's Wednesday, which means that KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm so excited about the song we're going to play today.
Good. And it's from Katie Guillen and the Girls. A lot of folks around here know them.
Yeah, they're one of Kansas City's most popular bands. They play that kind of, or they used to play, that kind of blues boogie music that has done so well in Kansas City for decades.
They used to play, suggesting they've changed.
There's a change. I've always enjoyed this group, but with the new album that's coming out this weekend, I've gained a new measure of respect and admiration for them.
This new album is Remember What You Knew Before. This track, Can't Live Here Anymore. Here's the new sound of Katie Guillen and the Girls. That's Katie Guillen and the Girls. Bill, you say this new album called Remember What You Knew Before takes some unexpected turns, and you mean what by that?
Well, this is the rockin'est track on the album, and you can hear those psychedelic flourishes.
Yes.
But other songs go in a folk direction, kind of a 70s feel, sort of there's some Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Southern California, and, you know, 1975
sound. It's more acoustic.
Yeah, there are lots of acoustic tracks as well. And you know, these three women had been successful playing, you know, straight ahead boogie, and they decided not to recycle that successful formula.
What do you think? Good decision or not?
I happen to think they do this kind of thing better than anyone in the Midwest. I'm not a big folk rock person, so that new sound doesn't speak to me personally as much, but that doesn't mean it's not entirely valid.
Katie Guillen and the Girls are celebrating the release of their third album this weekend. Where's that taking place, Bill?
They're taking things into their own hands, and they're hosting the event down at the Foundation in the West Bottoms, which is usually a site for wedding receptions or corporate events. But, yeah, that's, I think, typical of the way they're thinking. They're just going to do it all themselves rather than going to knuckleheads, which would be the obvious choice for them.
These guys are pretty fun to see live, right?
Yeah, they're really good. They compose solid songs that sound even better live. Katie Guillen is a remarkable guitarist, and got Stephanie Williams and Claire Adams.
They've been here before.
And they all have terrific personality, and they love what they do, and it shows when they play live.
That's Bill Brownlee talking about Katie Guillen and the Girls, their new release, Can't Live Here Anymore. Bill, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, we'll learn about one Kansas researcher's fight against the continued antibiotic resistance in microbes. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.